Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I am Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, we have bandwidth now.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hola.
Gentlemen, I would love to order a burrito right now, but I don't want to wait like 40 minutes to get here.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean,
we've all been there.
If only somebody had a 3D burrito printer.
All right, let's not get crazy here.
Yeah, or maybe you could call it your kitchen, dude. Like, it's not really hard to make a burrito.
Oh, yeah, I'll just get up and go make a burrito right now in the middle of this podcast, because that's what we do now, Justin, apparently the new rules.
Only if you have like a life partner that you could call upon.
It's impossible. Where's my tortillas in there, Justin?
Do you not have
California? You just assume I have tortillas in the refrigerator?
I mean, we certainly do in Texas.
I would love to be able to have things now. I mean, who wants to wait? Remember when they had like Prime Now when it was like 2-hour delivery?
Yeah. Whatever happened to that? Anymore? I'd be happy to go back to them ever delivering at the time that they say they're going to deliver.
Yeah, well, so obviously in the world we live in, we need things to move faster. It's not enough that I have to wait 45 minutes to get a burrito. It's insane. Who can live with like that? Like, could you imagine our ancestors having to wait that long? Fortunately, there's been some different ways to sort of progress and innovate. One of the things they've talked about is the idea of drone delivery. But one of the limitations of drone delivery is that, you know, having a quadcopter with a bunch of rotors landing in your front sidewalk or your front porch doesn't sound like the safest idea. But I wasn't aware of this company until recently. Have you guys heard about Zipline?
Zipline. Let me look them up. Just Zipline.
Mm-hmm. It sounds familiar. It sounds like a drone thing.
Yes. So they initially started with actually having airplanes that would fly like, or, you know, remote controlled planes that could drop like cargo in, let's say, parts of Africa where you needed vaccines or other things. And so they started that. Now they've built this basically a multi-rotor copter. And what's cool about it, if you go to the website, you can see the latest version of what they have, or you go look on YouTube. You actually go to YouTube to see what they're doing now.
Okay.
Because now what they do is basically, imagine a large drone that's attached to like a mast, and it has a little cargo pod that comes down. So let's say you put one on top of, you know, Subway, right? Inside Subway, they package your sandwich, put it into a bag, drop it in this little thing the size of a large lunchbox. It gets sucked up into the drone. Drone flies over to your house, but it's like maybe 100 feet above your house and lowers this thing. They call it like a droid, which is its own little unit that's got little controls to keep it from flying out of position. And that just drops the cargo down and then zips back up into it and goes away.
Well, so if I'm looking for it on YouTube, I'm seeing a bunch of stuff from a year or farther back.
Yeah, scroll back up, Brian. Uh-huh. See that main video you see there with the weird shuttle thing? That's it.
Okay, there we go. Okay, I see it. So it's got wings like like an airplane. So I guess when it's going fast enough, it's getting some of that lift. But then it could just sort of stop with the quadcopter. Hover. Yeah. And then drop stuff off and then go back.
Yeah, so what happens is that there's a part of it is for the quadcopter version. What they do is basically I think they have some of the newer videos, but yeah, you can see that what they do is it has like, imagine a large quadcopter, and then it has this little container that's on a line. You can drop down like 100 feet. And so just drop off and then unload a cargo, like whatever.
It's much bigger than it seems to be. Yeah. As we've talked about with UAPs, it's hard to really gauge the size of things in the sky. It looked like something about a handspan wide, but it's like the cargo appears to be, I don't know, size of half a human, maybe bigger.
What can load? It can carry 8 pounds. The whole thing is maybe about 2 meters across, and it attaches to these kind of weird looking towers. So their thinking is that like in the morning, these things are on top of Starbucks and other places, picking up things to deliver, fly off, deliver, come back, pick up more cargo. In the afternoon, they just move their fleet over to places that are doing lunch deliveries. In the evening, they're doing pharmaceutical stuff or, you know, other kinds of deliveries. So the idea is basically a fleet of these things. And the idea that they've figured to solve for the noise problem is the copter never comes down low. It stays up in the air pretty high, so you're not hearing the big loud noise, and you're also not worried about this thing that's, you know, the size of a, you know, riding lawnmower landing in your front yard, because it just stays way above.
That's brilliant. So it takes advantage of that inverse square law for the noise, because it's not nearly as loud as, you know, say a jet engine or what have you. But that's great.
Yeah. So kind of a cool future.
So you think that might be used more domestically?
That's their plan. They're rolling it out in Texas right now.
What?
Wow.
So, I haven't gotten my I haven't gotten whitelisted on the Waymo yet. There's all sorts of cool stuff.
Remind me of what Waymo is.
Waymo is driverless Uber.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they've got it in Austin. Yeah.
Wait, you guys have you guys done Waymo yet?
I haven't.
I have not.
I don't think I've ever been in a vehicle that self drove. I mean, that I know
of. So here's the cool thing about Waymo. So you see Waymo all over SF. Like, the Waymos are super, super dense. They've got LiDAR all over it. They're there. You see them. You pull out your app. You order a Waymo. Go from point A to point B. Couple things interesting about a Waymo. You get inside, and it's got very soothing music and lights. You see they've spent a lot of time thinking about the experience. It feels like an Epcot ride. So for the first 2 minutes, you're like, oh my God, this car is driving itself. After that, you completely forget and you're just in a ride. And it's a very smooth ride, very nice. Been in Waymo several times. The amazing thing to me is you just quickly forget, because it got like bathed in blue light. It just feels different than an interior. And so it's a very, very cool, you know, idea. And it's great for areas where they have the same routes. That's the beauty of like Waymo. The problem Tesla sort of started off with is the idea of like, we need to be able to have our car go anywhere and everywhere. Well, the problem with that is that there's all these unforeseen circumstances, shut down roads, things like that, where Waymos have a specific route. They map out the city. They know the route really well. When they run a Waymo service, they actually have people monitoring them, so they know where these, you know, where they are. There's construction stuff, whatever. So yeah, you've got Waymo, and then you've got also Zooks. You've seen Zooks?
I have not seen Zooks. Waymo is similarly saturated throughout downtown Austin, but like LA, they are rolling out their wait list, whereas Phoenix and SF have Waymo just on demand. You can just download it and use it, because Phoenix was really leaned into it. They leaned into driverless cars.
So go ahead.
So you're looking at Zooks. You want to describe that one now?
Yeah, it's a lot boxier, which kind of triggered a thought that I had actually this morning. This morning I was driving actually here earlier, and for the first time ever, I saw two Cybertrucks within maybe five car lengths away from each other. And it got me thinking about how popular Cybertrucks are getting. And that had me wondering, is that an Austin thing because Tesla's here, or is that just a in general thing? And then the follow-up thought was, I wonder how much longer that boxy aesthetic will be in, because it is such a striking design. And I thought, well, why would you ever get rid of it? Well, you would get rid of it for aerodynamics. I'm like, why? Because that's more fuel efficient. What does fuel efficiency matter if eventually all that energy is clean? And then I started to think, okay, go the other way. Imagine what you want is efficiency. And I just pictured a bunch of shipping containers driving around, and maybe even getting on the highway and sort of not physically linking up like a train, but essentially, you know, having a 3-foot buffer, all computer controlled like a train. And I eventually found myself following everything to its logical conclusion, where it ended up actually. I was picturing you walking into your office, which is actually a shipping container that actually takes you off onto the highway, and you don't even notice because you're just working. There's no need for safety belts because everything's computer controlled. You barely notice the motion, and you don't really need to look out the window because you're just in the office for an hour, and then you're on the other side of town, and you walk out into the office.
Yeah, I think you know, the idea of an automated future when you, because the Zooks is an interesting idea because it just looks like a thing designed to carry people, and they don't, you know, the problem they have with Waymo is what problem, but like Waymo still have a passenger section and a driver's steering wheel, which kind of makes sense now. But if you're thinking, you know, in the future, like, you know, yeah, you're not going to have that in an autonomous vehicle if it's always in an autonomous mode, because that's a waste of space. Where Zooks is like, we can make this space interior much bigger, nicer, et cetera. And to your point, like, once you can put anything autonomous on wheels, you can put anything autonomous on wheels. You want to have a tiki bar show up at your house to have a party. Do you put a tiki bar in a mobile autonomous vehicle? We've talked about the idea, I think, a while ago about, like, you want to do a Burning Man and you want to have 500, you know, hotel rooms.
Yeah.
Just have these suckers on wheels and they just show up and get there. And you might, we might talk about too, like, maybe just platforms that deliver containers. And I think it's a future we're heading to pretty quickly.
You know, well, I think for this stage of it, it's very interesting, the two solutions. Waymo is there to say, we can buy these cars stock, right? And put things on them that make them ready to be Waymos. Whereas Zooks is like, we're going to build our own specific vehicle and probably put them in more strategic places.
Yeah, yeah. I could picture eventually, you know, the modern home essentially having a dock for a perpetual room that is the travel room, where it's like, hey, kids, we're going to Disney. Don't forget to pack the travel room. And then, you know, y'all go to sleep in the travel room and you wake up most of the way to your destination.
Yeah, that future could be today. Hmm. So I think we're moving quickly towards that. We've been seeing some more, you know, developments with robotics innovation, et cetera. That's been very cool. And, you know, Justin and I talked about this before, but Brian, have we had a chance to talk about OpenAI's 01?
Yes. The reasoning one.
Yeah. So we're, you know, getting some more interesting sort of capabilities coming from that. People starting to experience this. And then I saw something, Brian, that we've talked about this idea repeatedly, and there have been versions of this. Social AI, you heard about this?
What's it do?
I feel like we have had two or three bites at this apple, but as AI has gotten better, I feel like the idea continues to come into clarity. And that is, what if you got exactly the experience you wanted out of social media because the only human.
This is bring back my botnet where I would post something and the whole world would gasp and be excited for me.
Exactly. So it's a yet another AI powered social network where basically everybody there is just an AI, and then you, and they're telling you, you know, you're great. You're awesome.
So I discovered a new use for chatting with ChatGPT. I was reading a book that managed to wedge two words that I was unfamiliar with into one sentence: perspicuous and Procrustean. Are you guys familiar with either of those words?
I have not.
I just glossed over them.
When I heard them, I mean, from context, it's clear that the guy wanted to make something clear without making it overly clunky, right? So within context clues, I got it, but I was like, the heck are those words? So I just asked, I wanted to make sure I was right. So I was like, what is perspicuous? What is Procrustean? And it gave me the definition. Perspicuous means clear. Procrustean means wedging something into a rigid structure. And then that would have been the end if it was a dictionary thing. But instead I was like, where do those come from? And it turns out that Procrustes was a villain in an ancient Greek myth that's written about by Plutarch. And Procrustes loved having people over at his house, but he was very rigid and insistent that they sleep in the bed that he provided with them. So if, say, their body was too large for the bed, he would cut them off at the shins so that they fit into the bed. Or if they were too short for the bed, he would put them on the rack and distort and torture them to make their body long. And eventually he got by the hero of the story. And it mentioned casually that it was written about by Plutarch. And I'm like, whoa, is that the same Plutarch that brought us the ship of Theseus?
Who is the hero? A Yelp review?
it was a dude who ironically forced him into the bed and killed him. It was a real Goosebumps kind of a myth. But because I heard the myth, it really locked in the word and the origins for it. And then I, you know, tried using it in a sentence a few ways, and I found out that, you know, I was like, oh, that's the same Plutarch that brought us the ship of Theseus and so on. And then perspicuous is of Latin origin, but basically, like, that's a good habit. And because it's old etymologies, you don't have to worry about hallucination or current facts or whatever. It's for vocabulary, it seems to be excellent for training you on new words.
Yeah, I think it's amazing to have, you know, something you can have a conversation with. You know, the joke about homeschooling is it guarantees your kids will be as dumb as you are. But with ChatGPT and these other models, then you have the capability for them to speak to, you know, a system that is incredibly well-read and well-versed in many different topics, which is cool. So, guys, I want to take us on an expedition into a cave. We're going to go deep, deep into a cave.
Okay.
And let's cave. Start planning. What are we going to bring with us?
Well, a flashlight, obviously.
Yep. Okay. Pants.
Maybe okay. An oxygen tank, you know, a bird in a cage.
Uh-huh. I'm going to go with shoes.
Okay. A hard hat.
Yeah. Socks.
Some soot in case, you know, my face isn't already covered like a coal miner's, then I can make sure to not too much, because I don't want to get canceled, but just a little bit of coal on my face.
I'm going to go with a shirt.
A toolbox, but don't worry about the tools. Maybe I'll put a ham sandwich in there.
I love that Brian has all this stuff, but he's buck naked, and I'm just a regular guy walking into a cave with no supplies at all.
Oh, one more thing, a handgun, and that'll take care of the rest.
Here we go. Calm down, Madam Vice President.
Ham sandwich, anything else? Any other food supplies?
I guess I would thermos. Say
enough for us to survive for 2 weeks. You never know. Oh, and a air horn in case we get caught and we need help.
Okay. How about some snacks? You need Cheetos?
Yeah. I think what do you think? Funyuns, bro?
No, I'm thinking more like beef jerky, you know?
Oh yeah. Let's do beef jerky. That's rich, rich in protein.
Yeah, so more filling.
No. Well, the problem with chips is that they might get crushed. We put them in our bags. Next thing you know, the bag goes against the wall and it's got a bunch of dust. Who wants that?
That's true, too. It's not the only problem. Apparently, an absent-minded tourist left a bag of Cheetos deep inside the Carlsbad Cavern.
Okay. Oh, that's... look, man, take nothing but pictures. Leave nothing but, Cheetos. Part of your soul. Cheeto bags.
The National Park Service made a stern warning because the bag was dropped in the big room, the largest single cave chamber in America, which takes a long time to make its way through. Left to fester in the pits of the cave, the bag of cheesy snacks sent a tiny shockwave through the local ecosystem. This is from iflscience.com. Quote, the processed corn softened by the humidity decay formed the perfect environment to host microbial life and fungi. Cave crickets, mites, spiders, and flies soon organized into a temporary food web, dispersing nutrients to the surrounding cave formations. Mold spread up higher in nearby surfaces, fruit die and stink, and the cycle continues, NPS said. At the scale of a human perspective, a spilled snack bag may seem trivial, but in the life of the cave, it can be world-changing.
Yeah, dude, think about that entire cave and the number of calories, like units of energy that once upon a time were, you know, forged in the fusion of the sun, and now, you know, through life cycles are in a bag of Cheetos. The number of calories, what, 1,000x, 10,000x, 1,000,000x inside that space?
Good Lord.
Yeah. So, stump guys. Just don't bring it in there. But also brings up questions why people worry about, like, if we find life on Mars. And that's why there's the idea that if we find life on Mars, it's cool, but it's also diminishes the prospects if we want to try to go, you know, colonize Mars.
It does. It actually makes it just a full on non-starter, because there's and I know I've mentioned this a million times, but there was a faction in Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, where it's like the geologists were almost like environmentalists, where they're like, humans are ruining all these cool geologic formations. Won't you protect them? They're so rare. And then meanwhile, the terraformers are all like, what's the point of this place if we can't give it a makeover? The moment, at least that is kind of a morally ambiguous discussion, whereas the moment life is in there, that truly is extraordinary and should be preserved, and humans should not go there and muck it up.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
unless it turns out to be identical to some boring stuff on Earth, in which case, screw it. Let's eminent domain that sucker.
It's a mixed bag, you know, like there's pro and con to all. Yeah, it is a thing where that's the one of the arguments for why, like, we have run into aliens is that as you're able to build a more precise and complex and sophisticated society and solve for a lot of your needs, you find ways to have much lower impact and don't want to have a lot of impact on other things. And, you know, end of the day, you just sort of like, you know, you find other ways to sort of explore without ways that we would detect or know that
we're. Yeah, well, we could certainly explore it. We probably would like hyper sterilize robots and have a, you know, kind of synthetic, perfectly sterile android proxies walking around on there or something, at least for a while, until we decide, screw it, let's move in.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of comes down to like the question of is that we use robotics to explore for a couple reasons. One, it's cheaper. It's the cheapest way to explore, right? Cheapest and safest. But when it comes to the amount of data, even people who run like Pathfinder and some of the Mars Surveyor will tell you that a human would get you way more data. You know, people are like, we could send robots. Like, no, like a human, a geologist in a really good spacesuit walking around can collect way more samples, do way more stuff for now. Robots will eventually get better, but robotic technology isn't there yet. But when it does get there, when you're able to, like, you know, be able to send up, you know, the fact that helicopters work on Mars still blows my mind. I understand the physics of it, but holy crap, helicopters work on Mars. And when you can start collecting tons of data, you then go, okay, why do we want to go there? One reason to go there is to, you know, make, you know, is to increase our odds of survival, big asteroid impact, whatever. But if your goal is exploration, you know, we use space telescopes. You know, one of the problems with the James Webb Space Telescope, it's going to have more data than there are astronomers to look at that data.
Seems like if only we had a little help from generative AI.
Yes, and I talked to one of the lead people working on analyzing that data, and the state of their AI tools to look at this stuff,
not great.
Not great. And because it's a matter of funding and whatnot. And it's just, it's like, you're like, because they mentioned like, we built this project to do this. I'm like, why don't we do that? Well, number one, we didn't think of that. Number two is, you know, well, think about it. Number two was ... hint, hint. The first thing we did was literally I had a grad student who knew how to code and who built that thing for me, you know, and a lot of science is just somebody had the spare time.
There is a point where, however much they've done with their AI, it might be worth it to just scrap all that's come before and start today, square one, working with the most advanced AI to write the most advanced AI for it. Because just the tools have accelerated so much.
I think you might be onto something, Brian. I think that is the you know, I've been working with a group that's doing biological stuff, and I've started looking at a lot of the tools that were around there and realized that, holy cow, a lot of these things are felt like they're built in the 1990s and just run on top of JavaScript. And, you know,
Yeah. Well, the reason I was thinking about it is in real life, we got dropped by, it turns out that Houston gets hit by too many hurricanes for our insurance company's taste. So they dropped all of Texas. And so I was obsessed with, okay, what did we used to have so we could get an equivalent one with a different company? And Bonnie was just like, just call the new company, describe everything we have and just get everything covered. And she ended up being totally right. And I was dumb to even try to focus on the legacy of what came before. It's like, all that really matters is get covered now. Go.
Yeah. Yeah. Sunk cost fallacy, man. That's like, it should be a whole podcast. Cause it is just the bane I know of my existence is that I often just spend so much time kind of going over the same thing again and again. And really what I need to do is just start off fresh.
I mean, I do a podcast series about it, but I've already put so much into everything else. It'd just be a waste of time.
That's a fair point. It's a totally fair point. So, what can be done? Okay.
I feel like there's more of a story here.
No, I was trying to make a joke about the sunk cost fallacy.
Got it. Never mind.
Yeah.
All right.
That is a thing that, I think about this as I help work on my projects and other people's projects. I think about the idea of, what is an AI powered company? What does it mean to build an AI company? And I had this realization, a big part of your time will be spent building tools, because really what you're going to do is you're going to be continuously figuring out things to automate. And the question is the automation making you more efficient than it's worthwhile? If you're spending too much time, if the tools aren't being used or aren't increasing your productivity, then it's not a good thing. And so that's a thing I think about a lot is, right now helping my wife out with a project for hers, I need a lot of data and I'm building tools to make the data. And I have to step back and go, okay, how important is that data? Is there another way to do it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the cutting edge. The bleeding edge is trying to figure out where the solutions are not only a quantum leap forward from the most advanced version of what we could do now, but also how set it and forget it can it be? Or possibly, right? Like, is it something that can continue to do what you need it to do? I think the goal would be to have these solutions be kind of like, a SimCity or something like that, where you just it's like, okay, and now here's a factory. The factory will just keep kind of making stuff as long as I check in on it every once in a while.
Yeah.
Hey, here's a factory for money for us, patreon.com/weirdthings. Support the show. Be a friend. Be our friend. And we'll be your friend with an After Things podcast that you get before anybody else. Head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings.
So in the world of augmented reality, Snapchat unveiled their entry point into developing an AR world. Did you see their glasses?
No.
I mean, this is not the first time they've done glasses, right?
Well, remember they did the glasses before with the camera, and the joke was the camera faced the wrong way. now they've built their own augmented reality glasses. To their credit, they're completely self-contained, and they fit
no supple woven cables.
No supple woven cables. They're doing a developer release, so it's like $100 a month or something as a developer to use them. They don't look horrible.
They definitely look like a piece of equipment, but not smaller than ski goggles.
Yeah, you look like you just walked out of Avatar 2 and forgot to return the glasses.
Yeah.
The problem is this, and probably a couple fold, is that they go do the demo and Spiegel demonstrates it. They've got a 45 degree field of view or smaller. So what you're back at is sort of that HoloLens, that very narrow field of view in front of you. So it's not immersive. When it is not an immersive field of view, it is a very different experience. And when it gets clipped off the edges, the illusion gets destroyed. And you watch the demo and it's very clear he's trying not to, pivot too far away from what they're looking at. But when they do, and you just see things get cut off, clipped off the field, be like, this is not ready for prime time. This is just not you. That is the problem you need to solve. That is really like fitting the whole thing on your head with no dangling cables. Great. But the moment I just move my head an inch to the right and the edge of the game, the thing I'm playing, is cut off, but I can still see the rest of the environment around me, that's just not good.
Yeah.
Well, and especially it just has to be like the mushy middle that we've been living in with AR for a very long time is that it needs to be useful. Yeah. Like if it's going to be there all the time, it needs to be something that you are very, very excited to interact with. And, you know, if we go back to, again, one of the greatest bait and switches in technological history, the Google Glass demo, that was exciting because in
welcome
a world,
to the new Justin Robert Young show. We're not bitter.
I know. But I mean, like in a world where smartphone technology was where it was at that time, that was a very interesting and cool idea. And it was something that you'd be excited to use. Everybody can understand walking through, needing directions to go someplace. And it would be cool if it flashed right in front of your face instead of having to look down. The problem with almost everything that's happened in AR is that there's nothing that hasn't been just a gimmick that you're going to kind of use once that isn't easier to do on another device, be it a watch or a phone, which currently exists and has battery that you can interact with it at all times. And that's really where, you know, there's the technological side of doing it, but really the practical version. And that is something that you have to solve for if these things are going to cost a lot of money, which we have seen consistently. Nothing has broken through on that. These things are always going to be pretty prohibitively expensive. They gotta be useful. We are living in an era where anything has to be something that you will use immediately and like. It's going to make your life better.
Yeah, in the demo, you'll notice one is we're only seeing kind of like you're not actually seeing what the viewer sees. You're seeing the field of view within the field of view. You also notice they're not even bothering with occlusion. So if you put your hand up in front of something, like the Apple Vision works on basically superimposing your hand over the object by like creating which takes a lot of processing, but it makes it more cool because now my hand is not behind the object in front of it. The utility thing, like, it's absolutely true. I kind of joke that like Google Glass felt like Larry Page getting frustrated that he's asked to make eye contact with people in meetings. And he's like, can you just build me something for it? I'm like, what if we gave you a pair of glasses so you could look at your phone while staring at people? And he's like, yeah, here's $1 billion, make it happen. And I want people parachuting. What? Just do it.
Just do it.
And they did it. And boy, did they do it. But, it's now an enterprise now. That's the whole, we're looking for enterprise.
It's enterprise. Yeah,
enterprise applications.
Because you see them all the time at businesses. You see them, you see them at businesses all the time, everywhere at businesses.
Every frame.
Every frame. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the good news about our era is that technology is so woven into what we do and so commoditized and cheap that we constantly have our lives made easier and better, and we can replace things so incremental progress can happen often. The bad news is for emergent technology is that there's a pretty large barrier to clear to make something worth it. And, I still think, I think I'm on my fourth or fifth Apple Watch. Like, if you don't use fitness tracking, I still don't know exactly how much it's a useful item. Like, it if anything, it almost is. I've always said that a smartwatch is about as useful as you looking at your phone without unlocking it. If you get a lot of use out of that and you would like it closer to your face, then a smartwatch is good. Unless you're doing sleep tracking, unless you're doing fitness tracking, at which point it's really, really good.
We've talked about this before. I do feel like there's a tremendous benefit, not to the Apple Watch, because the Apple Watch, you have to physically indicate to the whole world around you that you're looking at your watch. Whereas some of the other ones, you can hear based on the custom thumping, you can know what kind of alert's coming in without ever breaking eye contact with someone. And you could wait
for it. That happens on the Apple Watch.
Yes. However, if you want to see it, you cannot just look your eyes down and catch the thing at a later time. You must do the press release announcement that I am checking my watch, which ultimately was a deal killer for the Apple Watch for me.
No, it'll flash when it first goes.
When it first comes on, but if you want to wait 30, 40, 50 seconds a minute before finally it's appropriate for you to glance down and not move your hand at all, you can't do that. And that was socially the thing I liked the most about. I don't like to telegraph to people as I'm talking to them that a distraction has happened and I'm checking the distraction. And so I've not been a fan of how unsubtle the UI is on
that. That might be the only phase in your life. Somebody who has answered every spam phone call he has ever gotten while we are hanging out.
Yep. I do think that, yeah, that is the issue, because I remember like just stealing a glance at my watch just because of notification. I always get that, oh yeah, it won't be long. And I'm like,
it is a net negative. No matter what, it is an absolute net negative to have so much stuff blipping your wrist and you having to check in on it, Brian. I do totally agree that it is if I were around more people, I would probably think more about it. It is only because I live a fairly cloistered life and talk to the same, three people in person every single day. Now four, that I have a daughter. Like, that's pretty much it. And she doesn't even know what time is. So she's a long way away from being offended by me looking at my watch.
I was at a party the other night and I talked to somebody who's worth a company. Let's pull them up. Let's see if I can see how much of what they're doing is nudge. They're working on their own nudge.com. They're working on their own brain interface. And they're using ultrasound.
Hmm.
And so right now they're just using it for very simple applications, which is the idea that, press a button to make yourself go to sleep, boost your focus, whatever. But they are trying to work on like deep brain kind of stimulation in there, because they can use like phased arrays, whatever. But you can also, basically part of the idea behind that is that you can stimulate certain parts of the brain. And there's a limit, we talked about the limits of like what you can do to sort of signal in the brain. And even the problems like, the Neuralink has problems. Like Neuralink is a conceptually neat idea, but they put all these little gold threads in there. But like your brain moves around inside your head. Your brain is just not this just static thing. Otherwise, Aaron Hernandez would be a model citizen. So what happens is that, you have these things that go in there and kind of can get pulled out, and try to find
misaligned. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and then that's where you get into transcranial electromagnetic stimulation, where in theory, you just are constantly peeking at the moving target of the brain and using, I believe it's interference patterns, you stimulate with massive amounts of magnetism various parts of the brain.
Right. They tried to evolve from that here by basically making something that's portable by just using sound. So this is another form of transcranial stimulation. So, it's interesting because you do think about that. Like, how do you get the data into the brain or out of the brain? And, one approach is we'll just hardwire stuff into the brain. I certainly think for people who are dealing like physical impairments and stuff, I get it. I get, where that might seem to be impactful, but.
I got a question for you, for the panel. I think this will happen. I don't know when, but I was thinking about, if anybody out there has read, both Ender's Game and the trilogy that takes place with Ender as an adult, there was one sci-fi gizmo that I haven't seen in too many sci-fi things outside of it, but it was the idea that he had essentially it's unclear whether it's a robot, it's artificial intelligence that he could make the motions of talking as though he was talking, but he didn't have to create the vocal cord hum or anything. He could just, shape the words. I think it was like sublingual communication or something. Basically the AI would hear it as though we were talking. And in an age of LLMs where people have collected enough whale sounds to create large language models out of whale sounds and so on, it seems like picture a pirate's eye patch that you just wear around your neck that is collecting data, you know, right from your trachea, esophagus, or whatever. And it just tracks you talking. Maybe there's a bunch of calibration paragraphs that you have to say. And at that point, between the muscle contractions, it seems like it should be able to map the shapes you're making with your, that and a camera for essentially lip reading. Like how far do you think we are from the ability to have complete conversations where all you're doing is mouthing the words of what you're saying, and it's able to map your voice onto it, and the other person just hears you like it's the middle of a movie playing, and you're able to fully talk, and they're able to hear you?
I think part of it comes down to, like, I'm sure in a laboratory, I mean, if we're using, you know, fMRI and some other tools, you know, we could probably pick up a lot of that. It depends on how much hardware you want to have around you, you know, picking you up. And also that already assumes that you have the, if you already have the capacity for speech to actually stimulate those areas, then,
Well, the question is, like, what's the point of it? And the point is to have a conversation any place where there are other people around and you want to be discreet or quiet. Like, for example, out of courtesy, we have the penetration tester and hacker extraordinaire, Deviant Olive here. And during that time, I noticed that he made a habit of doing a lot of text to speech, but always with the phone extremely close and extremely quietly. And I asked him, was that a security thing? And he said, no. I just, you know, I don't want to interrupt other people by shouting at my phone. And for him, it was a matter of politeness. And I would imagine the next step, that's what got me thinking about it, was wondering if the next step would be just complete no sound sublingual communication.
I did see something get surfaced somewhere in my social media feed.
Yeah, there's some researchers at Austin, actually, University of Texas at Austin, have built, there's a lot of people doing that, but they built their own, you know, non-invasive BCI for doing this. But they're using like fMRI, I think.
Really?
Yeah, so they got to put you inside. That's so you got to put you inside of a giant fMRI machine, and then like have you think about the thing you're doing and pick up the signals. But that's the hard part. Is
oh, so you're going straight from the brain. I meant actually shaping the words with your mouth.
Right. I guess the point, if you're saying, a lot of what you're trying to do, though, is some of the sounds of shape of words comes from what your lips do, what your lungs do, and your diaphragm and whatnot. And so, I'm sure there's probably a lot of areas of research probably look into that. And so, like, yeah, like if you save the trouble of having to use, like, they're basically using an fMRI with a decoder trying to calculate what you're trying to think in your head. But, you know, it'd be interesting too to think about, like, if you could teach yourself Braille and be able to use some part of your body to, you know, talk in Braille without being consciously, you know, mouthing the words too. Or Morse code.
Yeah.
It's on the top of your palate, but mm-hmm. You know, the problem, these things just move so fast. So the way they learned to have people like figure out their speech is they had people, three volunteers required to lie in a scanner for 16 hours each listening to podcasts. And the decoder was trained to match brain activity, meaning using a large language model. There isn't a GPT-1, goodness gracious me. And so they're just trying to figure out the patterns and predicting what your brain was doing at the time. And then, you know, looking at the text and seeing like what was firing in your head. And that's one of these things too. You look at this where you find out some of this research is using really old technology, you know, that, you know, man, if we can boost that up, you know, imagine what we could be capable of.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, let's do some picks.
Heck yeah.
Oh man. I guess I wish I had more than The Wire season 2 as I continue my rewatch. It's an old friend.
Where are you at? The controversial season, The Wire season 2, as it changed a lot of the cast of characters away from the street level action that captivated so many to the docks of Baltimore, What is your feeling on season two?
I'm at the lull right before. I'm pretty much through it. I wish I could say it's much maligned, but I would say of the five aspects of Baltimore that get covered one per season, it's probably the least interesting. It has the least new, colorful, likable characters. Ziggy is certainly a colorful character, but he's eminently punchable.
Controversially yeah. colorful.
Just so punchable. Look, let me put it this way. Very excited for the best of all the seasons, season three, coming up.
I agree with you. Season three is the best season. I think anybody who thinks the season four people, get out of here. Come on. Season three is the best. All your favorite characters are in it. I like season two, though, mostly because the people that I was the most captivated by are the larger Drug Connect characters. Those are the characters that I really, really liked. And those really come to the fore in season two as you are dealing with how drugs get in to Baltimore to begin with.
It is surprising and fun to see like Joe go from a one note foil in season one to he's like, hey, I see an opportunity for a collaboration here with Stringer Bell and stuff. This begins the fleshing out of all the pieces of the puzzle, but there's so many spoilers incoming. There are so many bummers in season two, D'Angelo going out the way he did, investing in so many of the dock workers, just see him yanked from relevance. Watching McNulty spend the majority of the season just spiraling and destroying himself because he's not on a real case. It's just lots of bummers in there, you know?
Is season two the one with the intro, the pre-credits intro with McNulty just on like the bender of all benders that ends up in the diner?
Yes, yes. Where he asks, what do they got? And she says, you can have anything you want. Hard cut. Yes.
Yeah. That was like one of the things where, you know, when I was watching the most recent two seasons of The Crown, they cast McNulty, the actor from McNulty, as Prince Charles. And I'm like, get out of here. Like, stop it. McNulty. And that's the intro. The intro where it's like, even at his most rot bottom, and they go out of their way. This is it's old enough that you should have seen it by now. The intro to the episode is him going on such a bender that he drunk drives, crashes his car, and then is fascinated about where his car ended up. And so, like a detective, tries to get the trajectory right and then tries to run his car back into the pole the same way to see if he can get it to where it is before. He's beat all to hell, ends up in this diner and winds up having sex with the waitress because he's McNulty and his raw sexuality will conquer all. That's not Prince Charles. Prince Charles is not that dude. Get out of here, Netflix. I'm sorry.
I just watched The Forgotten with Dominic West, by the way. McNulty adjacent character because he plays. You remember The Forgotten with Julianne Moore?
I don't.
The woman, she's grieving for the loss of her child, and then they're like, "Well, you never had a child."
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And then, Dominic West plays this father, this former hockey player, and he plays that character really well. So I'd say he's one of these British actors that's a victim of being so good at certain kinds of roles that you're like, hey, now I'm supposed to believe you're British? And I'm like, well, I haven't been all along. You
know? Speaking of which, season two is also where he's trying to break apart the brothel. And so they decide he should try on a British accent. So you have a British actor doing a Baltimore accent, trying to do a British accent.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he's certainly one of these actors, just realize how capable he is.
I'll tell you. All right. So since we're on the classic HBO train, I watched the first episode of The Sopranos.
Ooh, does it hold up?
Yes. Yes, it holds up. You can understand why that show immediately hit. Number one, the cast is just amazing. They're still, to this day, it's just one of those accept no substitutes. Like, the characters are just, you're just happy that they're in your lives. Like, they're just such a full and rich and fully realized. And so the intro, I mean, and obviously the premise of The Sopranos is, you know, what would happen if one of the characters from Goodfellas or these Scorsese movies went to therapy. And that's where we begin. It's his relationship with Dr. Melfi, as he has had panic attacks, Tony Soprano. And, you know, he has to live a little bit of this double life where he is a baby boomer that is more in touch with his feelings as opposed to the older generation before him. So he is going to a therapist when his doctor recommends it to him, but he has to keep it secret because if you are in the mob, you can't be thought to be, you know, soft, have a, you know, crazy. So it's so great. And you can tell rewatching it, you're like, wow, like nobody's really come close to doing it. I watched it because when I went to HBO Max for something else, they have The Penguin as like, don't come coming this Sunday, The Penguin, which is in the Batman universe. And it's all stylized in red and black, which, you know, like it is a crime show. It's very much going for a Sopranos, but in Gotham City sort of idea. And so I'm like, well, what if I just rewatch The Sopranos? Ah, it's amazing. It's so good.
I don't think I finished the first season of Sopranos. It wasn't for lack of interest, whatever, just kind of got distracted. I did think it was interesting, like, the show got sold on the conceit of, you know, a gangster going to a therapist.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize quickly that that's really how they got the show sold. Cheap's a character, but it's really, we want to do a gangster show. The only way HBO is going to let us do this is if we say, what if we go to a therapist? We know what goes on in his head and whatnot. It's like, well, it's, you know, gangster stuff.
Well, also, and you could tell it's like, all right, how do we do the Scorsese voiceovers in an interesting way? And so it's like those classic Scorsese, like those were the days. Frankie Two Times was at the pool. Hey, Tony. Like, and they do like that two or three times, but instead of it just being a voiceover, it's him talking kind of in code to his therapist of like, you know, we had a board meeting, right? And all of a sudden they're punching somebody. It's it's good. And yeah, Melfi is a character that was similar to Ziggy in The Wire, controversial because you eventually realize like, no, you really care about Tony and the mob and the family and everything else, sort of including his real family, sort of like falls by the wayside, except for Carmela, who's always, I mean, Edie Falco is just such an amazing actress that you can't help but, and even like the few moments she gets in the pilot is just like, yeah, he's about to go into the MRI after he has the panic attack. And he's just like, you know, like Carmela, it just made me think of, you know, how precious our family is, our marriage. And it just the disgusted look on her face. Like, okay, whatever. It's just, he's great. The show is so awesome.
Yeah. Enjoyed it. I watched a movie I hadn't seen in forever, and it's not a, not what I would call a like perfect movie, but it's certainly I enjoyed it. It's one of these movies like, every 6 years, you know, I can go watch this movie. Did you guys ever see The Eagle with Channing Tatum and Jamie Bell?
No, not me.
Was that the one with the remake the plane in the desert?
No, that was Flight of the Phoenix, I think. Or
yeah. Oh, different bird.
This is the one where Dennis Channing Quaid. Tatum plays a Roman officer.
Oh, the Roman one. There we go.
You get sent to Britain and has a conflict, and then he has this grudge on his shoulder because his father had died and gone missing under mysterious circumstances and lost this Roman eagle, this gold emblem of the Roman Empire. And it was kind of a big loss on the family. And so the eagle is about him deciding he's going to go try to go get it. And it's a very, it's a smaller scale, like Roman epic kind of story. It's literally like him and his slave Eska, played by Jamie Bell, on this mission to go get it. So I think it's an interesting movie. I will say that it's, you know, for people to like it or get it or into it, like I kind of get it also too. It's based on a series of books. And I think that, I guess there's also, they did an earlier version of this. There was a British series called The Eagle of the Ninth, which they'd been based upon. It was directed by Kevin MacDonald. I will say it's interesting in that there is no female characters in it at all, other than background. There is like not a single speaking part by a woman in it, which I thought was kind of like an interesting sort of, I get making a small scale movie, but you know, to kind of like, you know, nowhere, you know, not a,
so it didn't pass the Bechdel test, huh?
Well, I don't know what test that is, but I mean, I don't know how they're here, but it was very, at least they weren't talking about a guy off screen.
Yeah, that's
they
true.
Solved it by not doing it. So it was, I would say that was the, like, I was like, ah, this is a, like I've ever seen, you know, some quite like that. But I, you know, other than that, you know, oversight, enjoy it. It's kind of fun. I like, you know, I like other stories about kind of Roman Empire stuff besides the sort of like the bigger one, the sort of a smaller scale story. But that's not my pick.
What's
my pick is, if you imagine Beetlejuice, the first Beetlejuice and Beetlejuice being the first half of the movie and the second Beetlejuice being the second half of the Beetlejuice movie. Beetlejuice, okay. Beetlejuice, really fun. So Beetlejuice, kind of slow start. And then when it becomes a Beetlejuice movie, it's maybe not as long as I'd like it to be, but really loved it. And Michael Keaton is, it's Michael Keaton.
It doesn't miss. So the man doesn't miss. Early, he's amazing. Middle, he's fantastic. Late, he's finishing like nobody's ever finished before. Michael Keaton, maybe the greatest American actor.
Yeah, 100%. You mean Michael Douglas? So the first Beetlejuice sort of ends with just this weird curveball, like, oh, by the way, all around the world, living and dead people live in harmony now. Just a little PS there at the end of the first movie. I guess that conceit goes into the second movie. Like,
I don't remember that from the first one.
Are you kidding? There's living people reading a book titled "The Living and the Dead: A Guide to Coexistence," and the joke is Jeffrey, what's his name? Principal Rooney says this thing reads like a stereo manual, just like they said with like your guide to being dead. So the implication being that now living and dead people are all living in harmony, so much so that they have a book on how to get along and make this work.
Yeah. I guess I thought that was just to that house or something, but yeah. It picks it up at a very, in a kind of a place where you spend the first half of the movie is the trajectory of the people, who they became and what after the fact. And then Jenna Ortega, her character and whatnot. I listen, you got William Dafoe playing a afterlife detective actor. He was actually not, he's an actor who played a detective, and in the afterlife, he is still an actor playing a detective, but he's the detective running around and reading from cue cards and stuff. There's a lot of just fun stuff in there, but
that's fun.
And Michael Keaton's just amazing as Michael Keaton, which the thing that I did like about the Flash movie was we got a revisit from a Michael Keaton as Batman, and like, hey, Universal DC, excited about Matt Reeves, what he's doing, Penguin, his Batman series. But I swear to God, if you do a full-on Michael Keaton Batman real sequel to the 1989 Batman in the way you do Top Gun Maverick, because I wasn't a big fan of the 89 Batman, but I love Michael Keaton, I love Batman. By God, all the money's yours.
Yeah.
All the money's yours.
I mean, I
read a thing about when they were doing press for the new Beetlejuice that really the original character in the first movie was almost entirely Keaton, that initially in the script the Beetlejuice character, then spelled like the astronomical term and not the way that it's styled now, was just like this vaguely Turkish character that showed up, and he was a little bit more evil and dark in the initial script. And Keaton was cast and didn't really love it. And so he asked Tim Burton if he could take like a spin on it, but like a lot of what you see, like he took over that shoot so much that they had to just edit the movie around him, like, and that character. But he came up with the voice, he came up with the jokes, he even came up with the hair. He apparently was like screwing around with how he wanted it to look, but it was like almost entirely Keaton. Like that, a lot of what was in there was not in the script. He basically took it over.
One of the writers, Larry Wilson, was my wife's screenwriting teacher.
That's amazing.
Really? Yeah. Neat guy. You look at that and you look at like Keaton's like a great actor. They do you get a backstory, by the way, of where Beetlejuice origin of it. Which is funny because he starts to speak in Italian and it's like an Italian movie plays out, and you're like, I want more of this. it's just he is fascinating.
I mean, so. You know, I remember I was very much in the demo for the Beetlejuice cartoon. That was huge. You know, I used to watch that all the time. Like, that is such a fertile world. And I was thinking about it with the Agatha show, which we watched the first two episodes last night. And there's just like, in that realm of PG-13 horror that's like creepy, but mostly creative, like where Beetlejuice, I think, like defines, like that is like the coolest thing about it is that it's fast, it's funny, it's creative, it's a little spooky, it's a little macabre, it's a little weird, but it always is surprising. Like, I don't know. I wonder why we don't see more of it, except the fact that it's probably really hard to do because you have to write really good stories and good characters. Well, also having Michael Keaton helps.
Wednesday was
good. And now's the time to do it because genre stuff is like really, really hot.
Did you guys ever see the 1993 movie of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing with Michael Keaton in it?
No.
I don't know if you guys will be able to hear this because sometimes audio doesn't play over the Google Hangout, but let me see if this plays and at least the home audience can hear. He does the Beetlejuice voice, but is talking Shakespeare.
True.
Hold on, this is other people are happening.
Being chosen for the Prince's Watch. This is your charge.
Oh no, he gets more into it later.
Bid any man stand in the Prince's name.
How if he will know?
Yeah, his character is kind of madcap like Beetlejuice. It was like the closest I've ever seen him get to that Beetlejuice gravelly voice insanity.
Cool. He Michael Keaton's awesome. Yeah, you mentioned Michael Douglas. So I had a math teacher, Mr. Drapella, who grew up with Michael Keaton's family. Knew his brothers. He's staying out with his brothers. And I remember, you know, the teacher Drapella being like, "And I have Michael Douglas, little Mikey. You know, Mikey now he's Michael Keaton. You know, like he's just Batman. Like who would have thought?" You know, it's just
that's amazing.
Yeah. Gentlemen, it's been weird.